Support for the Front Row on FM 89.1 comes from the Community Foundation of West Texas and from Citibank. Citibank's wealth management team of advisors, private bankers, and trust officers help customers create personalized strategies to help connect with long-term goals. More information on Citibank Wealth Management is available at 806-687-2955. And from Texas Tech's JT and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts. Vast opportunities abound in art, music, theater, and dance. Dean Noel Zoller invites you to enjoy some of the 800 performances and exhibits produced each year by vastly talented students, faculty, and visiting artists. Texas Tech's JT and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts. Vastly different. The Texas Tech University School of Music is presenting a concert this weekend that features a world premiere and world-class artists. We'll have all the details on today's show. Stay tuned. On today's edition of The Front Row, we are in the Texas Tech University School of Music, surrounded by a wonderful group of very noted classical musicians, composers, and artists, all in preparation for a concert that is coming your way Saturday evening in Himmler Recital Hall. And to tell us all about it is the person who is sort of the focal point of all of this, Philip Mann, who is the Director of Orchestral Studies here at the Texas Tech University School of Music. Philip, welcome to the program. Thank you for being with us.
It's always a great pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. I did bring a few friends with me
this time.
We have a full room here, and maybe your listeners can't, if they want to envisage it, we're all sitting around a big table, lots of smiling, energetic, exciting personalities here. And I think that's one of the most important recipes for a fantastic performance, actually, are some energetic, fantastically committed personalities. And chief among them here is our resident composer and producer, who's been partly behind this project from its inception. His name's Michael Fine. Your listeners will be very, very familiar with his work, if not his name, because he's not just a Grammy Award-winning producer, but has been involved in decades of some of the most extraordinary recordings of some of the greatest orchestras and artists in our business. And he's also had his hands in some of the finest orchestras in the world, like the Seoul Philharmonic, the Radio France Orchestra, Rotterdam Philharmonic, and is a little bit of a clarinet player and a composer himself. So I thought, well, what a way to build a project around a very talented composer with a burgeoning career who could connect us with some of my other favorite artists. And here we have Jason Vio, one of the world's most fantastic guitar players. I've had the pleasure of sharing the stage with him in some much more traditional repertoire and have had just wonderful experiences with him. And Alexa Still, I've been a fan of her flute playing since I was actually a kid in Colorado and enjoying her work up at the University of Colorado. And we've been trying to work out a way to share the stage for many years now. And Alexa is also working with a name that should sound familiar to your listeners, Tatiana Reutemann-Mann, my wife, and a fantastic piano, a member of our piano faculty here. And we also have Hideki Yazoto, our newest member of the School of Music faculty in commercial music in our recording studio. And this project is, it's 2.5 years in the making. And it's built around a specific piece, the Concierto de Luna, and I'll let Michael talk a little bit about that. But it's a new addition to the repertoire for solo flute and guitar. It originally came about with thinking about something like a companion piece to Mozart's Flute and Harp Concerto, something like this. But the notion of having something that's truly unique in the repertoire, an instrument combination for chamber orchestra, individual winds and percussion, that could potentially have great legs around the world. A lot of opportunities for different types of ensembles to play with this specific configuration of musicians, I thought was an interesting opportunity, and that's the kind of thing we're looking for here at Texas Tech, and maybe I'll let some other people talk a little bit about the project.
That sounds great. Well, let's talk to Michael Fine, and first of all, on behalf of all of our listeners who love Deutsche Grammophon recordings, that you've had something to do with, so let us thank you for that, and we're really, really happy that you're here.
Thank you very much.
So, but we might not know that you're a composer, and that this was all put together around your piece. Tell us about you and about your composition, Concerto da Luna.
I'm a very young composer, although a very old person. I began composing 7 years ago when my wife received a very terrible diagnosis of an incurable blood cancer called multiple myeloma. And as you can imagine, I was at my wit's end and also driving her crazy. And she said, you know, you have to do something so you don't keep bugging me about how I'm feeling. And I was on a broken down train in the Netherlands where I live, a beautiful bridge, train was not moving, and all of my toys ran out of batteries, my phone, my laptop. And I was getting, you know, what am I going to do? So I reached back into my backpack, I pulled out a piece of paper, made some musical stabs, and started to write a piece for flute and string quintet called Skipping Stones, just for the sheer hell of it. And I worked on it, then I went home and I thought, this is fun, let me try some other things. And that's how my, I daren't call it a career as a composer, began. This piece, I owe everything in this piece to Philip Mann. This is the second time he called me up with an idea that many composers would think is a bit strange. The first time was, could I write a concerto for oboe section? And I don't know if Philip knows this, but even before it was official, I simply that night started to write it and fairly quickly finished it. And then Phil called again and said he'd like a concerto for solo flute and solo guitar. I'd never written a note for the guitar. So I cheated, as many composers will do. I looked online, I found the Villa-Lobos guitar concerto. I said, oh, a guitar can do this, and the guitar can do this. It turns out the Villa-Lobos concerto Jason could play was quite difficult as well. But I began to write the piece, and now I'll let everyone in on the secret of the name. I was watching a Korean television drama called Hotel del Luna. And the drama is about a hotel that appears at the full moon, and its guests are entirely the recently deceased, and the not so recently deceased, and they get to have a break before they trundle off to the afterlife. The whole thing is under the moon, and that's how this piece got its name, and that was how it started. It's all moonlight. Even the last movement, which is a sort of fiesta, is a fiesta under moonlight. Now, when Philip told me who the soloists were, I was trebly inspired, Philip, Jason, and Alexa. And almost everything I write usually has someone's sound or sensibilities in mind. It makes it easier for me if I know the player. And by chance, Alexa and I met, I think a good 30 plus years ago, is that possible? In New Zealand, where she was the remarkable first flutist in the New Zealand Symphony, and in what was a rather unusual orchestra, I very quickly identified Alexa as the best player in the orchestra, and with all respect to the many fine musicians, they're better than the orchestra. And I sort of quietly walked up to her and said, well, who are you? You're really good. And we made a number of recordings of flute concertos together, including some wonderful new pieces, some New Zealand composers. So for me, when Philip said, Alexa still, I said, yeah, great, let's do that. And Jason, I looked on, you know, iTunes, Spotify, et cetera, and I found some pretty incredible playing from this guy. And I thought, okay, I can make this as hard as I want. And and the other thing about new pieces are, having been the artistic director at some orchestras when we commission pieces, usually the part's rolling in about 3.5 seconds before the concert. And I decided, you know, because I've been on that side of the bench as well, I can't do that to these artists, so I wrote it fairly quickly. Philip said 2.5 years. I think I had about 2 months to do this, but that's also good because then you're focused, you're going to write it. And I just sat down on a couch in my house and started. And whether it's good or bad or somewhere in between, we'll all find out soon enough.
Well, Alexa Still is a renowned flutist, and here you are to do this concerto. Michael Fine hands you a piece of score, and says, here you go. What do you do?
Start. Yeah. The first thing I do is scan through and look through the hard stuff, right? Because that's where you're going to start, make sure I can technically actually do stuff. It's very clearly written. He was really responsive. I sent Michael notes almost straight away. Yeah.
Thank you.
And he made some changes, which was very nice.
on your but, recommendation, right? After having taken
just,
a look?
Just yeah. saying, you know, this is a little gnarly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm really, really thrilled to be here. And it's really, I feel so lucky to be in the middle of this bunch of people. Right. It should be a great experience.
To play a wonderful piece with a lot of great colleagues.
Yeah.
And also, I think you'll do some academic work while you're here working with some students.
Yeah, a few classes. Yeah. It's always
excellent.
Good fun.
Right. Excellent. Yeah. Well, we're happy that you're here. Yeah. And what do you want the audience to take away from your performance?
I think they're going to feel that some of it has, it's the textures of Michael's work are quite dense. There's quite a lot going on. But you can sort of stand back and hear bits of lilting and bits of dancing, and it's quite beautiful.
Right. And it's multi-movement work. Three movements, right. So three different kinds of...
Three characters.
Yeah.
Three characters. And yes, unfortunately, my music is dense, which gives Philip a lot of... But that's okay. and the other thing I warn listeners about are my penchant for very quirky rhythms, which I'm trying to get over, by the way. But there are little medieval bits in this.
It's very listenable.
Good.
It's very listenable.
Good word.
Yeah.
Right. So a person coming in can process it and accommodate it.
Easily.
Yeah, easily.
Right.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, the other artist involved is the solo guitarist Jason Vio. And again, on behalf of our listeners who love your recordings played on the radio and your performance today and all of the things that people would know you from, welcome to Lubbock. We're glad you're here.
Yeah. Last time I played here was about 20 years ago.
So not a huge amount of literature for guitar and orchestra beyond the Spanish concertos, things like that. New music for guitar and orchestra? Lots. There's lots. Tell me.
About 200 published concertos for guitar and orchestra.
He plays them all, of course.
No, I've only played 40 of them. But this is, I don't know, I guess a lot of my work now is premiering new stuff. So,
okay.
And I always love the opportunity to do it. So.
Right. So what did you think when you received the score?
Wonderful. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's kind of like what you were saying.
Yeah.
Like as a professional, when you've been in this business a long time, your first thing is like, okay, you got, you know, to be, or, you know, mm-hmm. you become organized about it. And so it's like, all right, what's the hard stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the tempos, time, tempos, rhythm. Can I actually play this?
Right.
And that's also a problem with me too. Is like now composers are always like, oh, I can make it as hard as I want to make it, you know, or difficult or whatever. I was like, no.
We live in an age of MIDI type stuff with computers.
And right.
It's possible for composers to write stuff that's really just hard to even hear. I think sometimes.
Right. In this concerto, do the two of you work together?
Oh, yeah.
It's very symbiotic sort of.
Totally.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Or I'm going to find out in the rehearsal today just how much of that, because she was, Alexa was here yesterday,
mm-hmm.
actually, a day early, and I just got here. So I'm looking forward to.
I think one of the characteristics of the work from the conductor standpoint and the ensemble standpoint, it's very much a concerto grosso with multiple voices that share equal importance.
Mm-hmm.
So solos being really passed around the orchestra, frequently when the two soloists will be even positioned in some ways almost within the orchestra, not out just in front of mm-hmm. the orchestra, will often not be accompanied just by the orchestra, but have another solo voice playing with them, either in juxtaposition with them or sometimes almost in unison, but not necessarily in pitch unison.
Mm-hmm.
And for as a conductor, I think one of the great challenges, but indeed opportunities of a work like this is Michael is extremely economical and creative about his lack of specificity in the instructions in the score. He really allows musical and creative decisions to come from the artists. I think for as a conductor, working in his music is a lot like working in let's say, for instance, a Baroque concerto grosso, where you may only have a title of a movement. Now, he gives us more information than that, but there's a lot to unpeel, as it were. You know, each measure, particularly what, as he mentions, his penchant for quirky rhythms and things like this, and sometimes a little, there's some density to the writing, but at the same time, I find that as a great opportunity because it allows me to then kind of dig in, start peeling away different layers, finding what I think is special about different things, highlighting them in a way, elucidating them from textures, and then perhaps almost like on a laundry line, starting to hang different things that I think on top of each other until you suddenly have this multifaceted kind of palette of changing colors and textures and voices that come in and out in almost like an interior conversation. I'd mention that your listeners, we had such a fantastic response to our recent performance of Michael's Suite for Strings with Ensemble Bravura. And this project really fits into a larger vision that I have for that ensemble here within the school. It's the school's newest orchestra. It emphasizes collaborations with world-class guest artists, but also our finest and most well-known faculty. So Kim Walker, our wonderful director, but former principal bassoon of the London Symphony Orchestra, is playing in the orchestra for this. Mark Morton, one of the few orchestral musicians who I know who has won multiple principal positions at different orchestras, and I don't think he's ever lost an audition. Kind of incredible. And Tatiana Reutemann is also playing. So we have some of the best and brightest of our faculty and staff all featured in this ensemble. And now to then embrace a new challenge, which is beyond just giving a successful world premiere of a piece with a compositional language that's somewhat unfamiliar to the students, but to now embrace something that is an even greater challenge, which is the notion of recording. So when I was thinking of commissioning Michael, the notion of recording, you can't get away from that. He's one of the great recording personalities in our business. It would be crazy not to take advantage of that kind of talent while here on our campus. So
adding another layer of tension and stress for me, thank you.
Yes, not to hijack your interview, but a wonderful question might be what it's like to wear the hat of both producer and composer at the same time.
Right.
And I would say, though, that the chance for our students to experience the actual process of recording sessions is something that indeed, most professional musicians rarely experience, if ever, in our business anymore. Even people in the highest level orchestras. Right. This is a rarity, and it's a very, very special thing.
Not so much today. That's right. Yeah.
Recording is hard. Yeah. I mean, it's way, way harder than performing. I mean, it took me a long time to actually realize how I thought about that or how I felt about it. Like, it's like performing, it's like, it's a gig.
It's transient.
Recording is hard.
Indeed, there's nothing, I think, better for building an orchestra than the process, the intent, focus, and incredible sustained energy and discipline that has to happen within a recording session. Because it's almost like multiple performances put together with a clock in the background, and you have to. You have to get your best out there by the time the race is over. Right. And one of Michael's extraordinary abilities and qualities as a producer is how he can be good cop, bad cop, a motivator, a consoler, all of these things, and almost like an orchestra psychologist, and can make sure that everybody is positioned in a place to not just develop and bloom and put their best out there. In the best of circumstances, and I've experienced this in our first, where I met him for the first time was working in a Brahms recording with the London Symphony Orchestra. And he puts the musicians and the orchestra in a position where they're willing to take a risk. And for me, that is how great things are possible. And so it's been a great opportunity.
Right.
Well, I need a soloist psychologist too. So. Oh.
that was my minor solo instrument psychologist.
Right. So, recording arts is that where you?
Hideki
will...
is extraordinary. He does everything.
Okay. This is where you will join us. Yes.
Yes. So I'm very new. I just joined the faculty 2 weeks ago, and this is my first project, and it's just extraordinary. I'm so honored to be able to work with this fantastic musicians and people here. So we'll be recording using 26 microphones. And so we're setting up all the new equipment and very exciting. Yeah.
Great.
Let's hope it works.
Yep.
Yeah. A shakedown just as a right at the time that it's happening.
Yeah. The thing about recording is you can have the greatest musicians in the world, the best equipment, and you still have no idea what's going to happen at that first moment.
Yep.
And sometimes people say the first take, but we're all getting used to each other in the first take. This is the ultimate blind date.
Yep.
This kind of recording. I mean, Alexa and I have worked together. Philip and I have worked together. We're first meeting. Hideki, we're first meeting. And we only have one goal in mind. A recording session is like a rehearsal on steroids. And it is the best rehearsal. I remember years ago, Charles Dutoit said to me that the reason the Montreal Orchestra attained its level of greatness was simply through studio recording sessions. Because you think you're prepared to play a piece of music. And I know this also as a sometime performer. When you sit down in front of a microphone, you discover everything you've never done right, whether it's a note, a rhythm, a sound, a phrase, it's all there. And in the recording session, you have to get it right at least once. Now, the current generation of artists knows what we can accomplish in post-production, and we have a lot of tools at our disposal, but nothing, and I say this with 30, 40 years of experience, nothing replaces having great artists. It's not about what we do. I'm a secretary. I'm sitting there, that's good, that's not good, that's bad, putting it all together. But at the end of the day, you have to have great performers to make a great recording. Because even if we can fool you with a recording that's not good with voluptuous sound, and we can take the ear away from bad things with multi-track mixing, a good listener knows there's nothing really going on. And for me, the worst thing is getting a good review of a bad recording. I don't mind a bad review of a good recording because I know I've done my best work, the artists have done their best work. But if I know I haven't done my best work and the artists were not really up to the level, I hate seeing a good review of that because that means I can't trust the people that are writing about the music or listening to it. And we all need criticism. We all need good criticism. So what's going to happen when we start to record this? We've got great artists. We've got a great Tonmeister with great equipment. I've done this for a few years myself. Let's see. But what Philip alluded to, I think I do my worst work recording my own music because composing involves a different side of the brain. So things that when I was recording, I've done a lot of recordings of new composers. And I can be quite scathing in the booth to my colleagues. Oh, my God, you listen to that unprepared modulation. And then I make all those same mistakes. And I like them because it's what I'm writing. So I have to sort of separate. I have to be completely objective about this. If something doesn't work, I have to say, let's fix it. Let's change it. I can't be emotionally invested in the work as a composer. I have to just do a professional job as a recording producer. And I can tell you, it's the hardest thing for me. So they're going to help me.
Great, excellent. When are the recording sessions?
We're starting tomorrow.
Yeah, here at the music school?
That's right,
yeah.
In the Hamley Concert Hall.
All right, good luck.
Thank you.
Especially with the buses that drive by. That's mm-hmm. You might have some extra sounds coming, so good luck with that. Philip, your wife is here, and we don't want to leave her out of the conversation. There must be something else going on as well in this concert.
Well, of course, the project really started or centered around the premiere of this new concerto. And I would want to add just one thing to all of Michael's eloquent comments there, that the one word he didn't speak about that really makes all of what he talked about possible is trust. Trust between the artists to put their... Well, I think it's fascinating. We often talk about when we do a world premiere of a piece, how a composer has to actually entrust the future of that piece and the success of that piece into the hands of a performer. And that's sometimes actually a difficult thing for a composer to do. But interestingly, and I guess somewhat uniquely, the recording process is the only time artists experience that feeling ourselves, where we put our performances, and for posterity in the case of recording, in the hands of a producer who's making some of those decisions of what makes it on a disc. And there's no accounting for taste, because one of the things that Michael and I have always connected on is the utmost importance at all times of an extraordinary string sound. And it really, that's the first thing for me with an orchestra. And I could tell, based on some of his comments, we're at Abbey Road that one day or with other places where we've worked together, that that's the starting point. And that's the place where I think we start to build something in a session. But I come back to this notion of trust. And so for me, it's sharing this stage with artists who we've already even gained trust through going to battle together and coming out with memorable, wonderful experiences. As we look beyond just the concerto, we have an opportunity of having these fantastic artists in town. And, you know, having soloists on our faculty like Tatiana, we suggested that we did another world premiere recording of a piece that hasn't been recorded yet, but it's a favorite of Alexa, and I should probably let them talk about it. It's Aaron Kernis's Air, and it's really been their idea coming up with that selection for this work. And after hearing them rehearse, not only am I very excited about the performance, and we're going to add a performance of this to our program at 7:30 on Saturday before Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, I actually am quite taken by the combination of that work and the concerto. I think the sound worlds that they inhabit have some interesting similarities, and I think they'll complement each other, that they taste right together. Right. But I would kind of turn it over for them to talk a little bit about it.
I see you have the score.
Yes.
Open in front of you. So tell us about this music.
So actually, Ms. Still suggested that we do this piece. I mean, one of the reasons is that there is no recording of this piece, at least that's extant.
No, not for flute and piano.
Yes, not for flute and piano. So that idea really fascinated me, to make a recording of something that doesn't exist in the recording body currently. And then, you know, she was very kind to send me the score, and I thought it was wonderful. It's beautiful music. I do think that it has some similarities to Michael's concerto. He was talking about the penchant for squirrely rhythms. There's a lot of that.
Squirrely.
Quirky. Oh, sorry. Yes, there's a lot of squirrely rhythms in here that the listener will hear. But this piece, to my ear at least, is written very much in the American idiom, this bitonality, polytonality, that it's very tonal in nature. You will hear distinct, clear harmonies, but there isn't a tonal center to the entire piece. It's always very nebulous, and that's what creates this atmospheric sensibility about this. Also, rhythmically, in addition to the squirrely rhythms, there's this wonderful, very clustery dissonance section. But also, one of the interesting things about it is that the flute and piano textures, they kind of float. And occasionally they line up, but most of the time they kind of, to my ear, they float parallel to each other because of the metric system that's used. There's always a meter and a time signature, but the way it's written is very, very interesting. And I think it's quite lovely that creates this parallel flow of both instruments. And of course, it's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to work with Alexa.
When did you come across the Kernis piece?
Oh, I've known about the Kernis for a long, long time. And I admire his music very much, and it struck me that it would be a good fit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thrilled to get to play with Tatiana. She's a magnificent player.
Excellent. Is it all through composed? One movement?
Yes. Yes. It's definitely one. And the tempo changes and fluctuates a little bit, but again, the squirrely rhythms and meters, they obscure the actual tempo, and the music just flows.
All right, the concert is Saturday evening in Himley Recital Hall at the Texas Tech University School of Music at 7:30 p.m. Music by Aaron J. Kernis, music by Modest Mussorgsky, and the world premiere of the Concerto de Luna by Michael Fine. Thank you for everybody being here today for this wonderful edition of The Front Row, and best of luck in the recording sessions and in the concert. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's edition of our program will be on our website, kttz.org, later today. Rachel Boyd produces The Front Row. I'm your host, Clint Barrick. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Support for The Front Row comes from the Lubbock Symphony Orchestra, announcing the 2019-2020 season. More information is at lubbocksymphony.org.